Dr. Henry G. is a paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and a senior editor for the journal Nature. He has written In Search of Deep Time, about our past, A Field Guide to Dinosaurs, Jacob's Ladder, about the human genome, and The Accidental Species on Human Evolution. He's also a blues musician and a big Tolkien fan. He used, 20 years ago, of course, since the Fellowship of the Ring today, he used to edit the Journal of the Tolkien Society, and he wrote an acclaimed science fiction trilogy, The Sigil, spanning millions of years of the universe. His latest book is A Very Short History of Life on Earth, spanning 4.5 billion years. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, Jim.
Our future. Before we get to the past, you've been writing about this in Scientific American as well. We're doomed as a species. Our days are numbered, you reckon, Henry?
I apologise to anybody who gets frightened. Since I wrote that, it seems to have given the entire world a case of the screaming abdabs. But I do think that the human species is doomed. Not immediately, so don't cancel Christmas for that reason. But within a few hundred to a thousand years, maybe. And sometimes it terrifies me, but most of the time I just sit down and have a cup of tea and walk the dogs, because when all's said and done, you've just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other without falling over. Because the population, the world population, is still going up, but the rate of increase has dramatically slowed. By 2100, it might be less than it is now, and it's going to go down rather fast, and there may be no way to stop it. So I think we will be extinct fairly soon. Mind you, I'm a paleontologist. By soon, I mean hundreds or thousands of years, but it's soon for me.
Yeah, and women become more empowered and connected in even the poorest countries and start making different decisions about the sizes of their families. So I think we have this fuzzy notion of a less stressed planet with habitats reviving as a result, but you don't see salvation there.
I think we've used up most of the resources that we've got. A number of things have come together, like the world economy has been essentially static for 20 years. There have been a few ups and downs, but it is not growing. And then you put in another few things, like today's generation has to work harder to achieve the wealth of, say, the boomer generation. And when you think back, you know, a few generations before that, even quite modest people of modist means had servants. There are fewer resources to go around. And we're using more and more of them. And then you look at the evidences that human beings are using up between 25 and 40% of all the primary production. And that means all the food that plants make out of the sun and carbon dioxide. That's humans, just one species is using all that resource. So there's less and less of it. At the same time, people are beginning to use the world more sustainably. It's not true, as some people say, that people are doing nothing. In developed countries, per capita energy use has been declining since the 70s. And that's partly driven by market forces and partly driven by the fact that I think we have to make do with less. Unless there's another green revolution or some unexpected energy source, I think human beings are set for decline. But the main reason I think human beings are set for a fall is because of a very obscure theory called the theory of extinction debt. And yeah. I published this paper by some ecologists in Nature in the 90s. If you imagine a load of habitats, and they're all in little patches of habitat. So most things don't live in one continuous patch of habitat. They live in little patches that are spread out. So you might find a butterfly that lives in a woodland and it has to fly across a grassland to get to another piece of woodland. So patches of habitat are spread around unequally. And what this paper showed is there are basically two kinds of species. There's dominant species and dispersor species. And dominant species tend to monopolize the habitat patch they're in. Dispersor species tend to, when faced with dominant species, tend to fly off to some other patch of habitat. But then I realized that we only have human beings occupy only one continuous patch of habitat, and that's the Earth. And we're dominant within it. So think of that. And then here is the killer of this paper. It showed that when you have a dominant species in a patch of habitat, you only need a small amount of habitat degradation to condemn that species to a certain extinction, no matter what you do. So I have a feeling that we are already doomed for extinction fairly soon because of that simple, the simple calculus of extinction debt. We've built up a huge, basically a debt on the environment, and we're doomed. That's it. Please, will the last person turn off the lights? I've got to work this through a bit more. So it's not as though I've plugged in any numbers or anything. This is just me thinking aloud. But it strikes me as making some sense. I hope somebody who knows the math better than I can come along and show that I'm wrong.
I was fascinated by your extinction debt idea. I once interviewed a very rich man who had flown across great swathes of the world by helicopter, and he remarked on how deserted so much of it still is, and he wasn't worried about overcrowding. But to you, that's not really the point. It's not. It's we're imperiling ourselves because the overcrowding isn't about total area dominated by humans. It's what we're occupying that's more germane.
It's what we're using. I remember flying from Beijing to, where was I flying to? Amsterdam, probably. And when you do that, you fly north from Beijing. And as soon as you do that, it's complete mountainous wilderness. And then you fly across Siberia, which is complete wilderness. And you fly over northern Europe, which is surprisingly deserted. And then you land in Amsterdam and you think, goodness me, there's plenty of the Earth. But a lot of this Earth is largely uninhabitable. And virtually all the land that is capable of being farmed is being farmed. Even though people aren't around, that doesn't mean that people aren't using the resources. And I was flying in another, you know, I'm not rich and fly in a helicopter. I just have to go in coach, but I do like to have a window seat. I was flying over Indonesia and I thought, this looks very jungly. But then I flew, we flew closer and the jungle was actually palm oil plantations instead of jungle, which was a bit depressing. Somebody reading my article said, well, I do mention in the article back in the 60s, Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb that said the human population is going to expand beyond all control and we're all going to starve to death. Now, not long after that, a fellow called Norman Borlaug developed very high yield strains of wheat. And some researchers in the Philippines developed high yield strains of rice. And that basically saved the world from starvation. That was called the Green Revolution. And somebody said, well, you know, Henry G has this point, but what's to stop some other Green Revolution coming along and saving it? Well, I've just read a really good article in the New Yorker that somebody pointed out to me called Creating a Better Leaf by Elizabeth Colbert. It was published on December 6th. And it's talking about new ways to make plants more efficient. In other words, when plants photosynthesize, now I don't say that at home unless no one's around and you haven't got very wiggly teeth like me. When plants photosynthesize, they're very inefficient, a bit like old-fashioned light bulbs. Most of it just goes out as heat. So there are various efforts to tweak plants genetically to make them more photosynthetically productive. But the fact is the first law of ecology is that there is no such thing as a free lunch. If plants could have been made more productive, evolution would have made them more productive. So this suggests that there is some huge cost to making the plants more productive, such as the viability of the plants, or that they're very fussy, or that we, or as with the Green Revolution strains of wheat and rice, we have to use a lot of artificial fertilizers to keep them going. People say what we need is some new energy sources like nuclear fusion. Well, I am of a certain age, and I remember going back to the year dot. When people ask when nuclear fusion will be viable, everyone says it'll be viable in 30 years. Now, I've been working as a science journalist for 34 years, and they still say it'll be viable in 30 years. So don't hold your breath there. I think the only way to maybe avoid this extinction, and I deliberately don't talk about this in the book, and I say I don't talk about it, is to move into space, which various people are talking about, and maybe construct orbital habitats. In other words, establish more habitat patches, disperse into more habitat patches, become a disperser rather than a competitor. Now, that could work for a bit, but I think what will eventually happen is the species would evolve, and we won't be human anymore. We'll just be lots of little species evolving in different habitats that don't actually meet each other very often. I'm quite encouraged by space travel, and in the book I say that a heartening thing is that the environmental catastrophe in which people say we're living in isn't as catastrophic as people think, because it hasn't been going on for very long. For example, the internal combustion engine, which causes such fuss and brouhaha, was only invented in 1876, so hardly an eye blink ago. And quite soon, the internal combustion engine will be extinct. It'll be a heritage item, like a typewriter. People will drag it out at vintage car fairs and then put it away again. But most people will be driving electric vehicles or not driving anything at all. And so the age of the smokestack industries, the internal combustion engine, has been very short. Similarly, people talk about plastics and how dreadful they are, and plastic bags in supermarkets and things like that. I remember in England, when plastic bags were introduced, it was quite recent. I was about 10, and my mum would drag me to the supermarket, and I'd say, "Oh, mum," and she said, "I didn't raise enormous great youths like you, if not to help me get things off the top shelves of the supermarket." She's very small, my mum, but quite fierce. But I remember then plastic bags were being introduced. This was in the early 70s, and even then people were wondering about biodegradability. So it's not as if people have been blithely wrecking the environment without thinking about it. There have been some positive changes, but as I say, it could be related to an underlying depletion in resources, so we've had to become a more canny and learn to do more with less.
It's funny you mentioned cost. Unforeseen cost, because that's part of the glass darkly, I think. And I remember Michael Crichton wrote Jurassic Park, and his famous remark was that we can't see the future. Even someone like you, with such a knowledge of the past and of science and biology, and you're also no stranger to future prognostications, but his analogy was that when New York City seemed to be getting overrun by horse dung from carriages, it would be terrible in 100 years' time, and no one could imagine motor cars. But, of course, motor cars may have saved the horse dung problem but have created another problem, and that's always the problem.
Well, exactly. I mean, as someone once said, and it's a testament to this that nobody really quite knows who said it, prediction is very hard, especially about the future. Now, you see Victorian prognostications of the future, and it has ladies in crinolines riding around in steam-driven airships. And it's exactly as you say. I suppose there is a danger of being a too Micawberish and saying, well, something will turn up. Well, it might, and it might not. And you alluded to the empowerment of women. Well, I think that is the single biggest development in human civilization that has made people more comfortable. The emancipation of women in terms of politics and reproductive autonomy, I mean, I'm speaking in very sort of harsh biological terms here, it's only been about a century old. And yet, since it's happened, the workforce has potentially doubled. People live longer. They live more fulfilled lives. People are more educated. And it's largely to do with the control of resources by women. Now, here is a little factoid to cheer people up. In 1970, when the world population was expanding at like 2.1% a year, no more than one in five children completed elementary school. Now it's one in two. And by 2030, it should be everybody. And now we'll be talking about people trying to complete secondary education. And when people are in education, they're getting more knowledge. They're not going off and having babies very young. And they are making a better life for themselves. Now, this, of course, increases various demands because people want to live a more aspirational lifestyle. So this causes problems. But in the short term, I think our lives, as both and all genders, is more comfortable than it would have been had women not been emancipated. People have fewer babies and they have them later, which contributes to the decline in the world population. But there are also other reasons, as we've talked about, Jim, such as it's difficult these days to find a home, to get a mortgage, to live in the style that your parents were accustomed to. And I think that's partly the general worldwide, that's to do with the general worldwide status of the economy, which is ultimately to do with we're reaching the upper limits of what the earth can provide for us. Now, the population will go down, and that might put less strain on the environment, but that decline has to be managed. And I think we'll be able to manage it more effectively with a more educated workforce, which has been produced by a century of female emancipation. So there's all sorts of pluses and minuses in all these things. I don't think there's any simple narrative that can be woven out of all this.
No, but without spending all day on your doomsday scenario, in its favour, the economic growth paradigms you talk about are unsustainable, but it's the treadmill that we show no signs of getting off, because as the world educates itself and becomes better off, that demand for resource use, etc., accelerates, and that'll be the real death knell that we can't avoid, won't it?
Well, yes, but because of the education and technology, we're learning to do more with less. Now, I mean, we all remember light bulbs made out of tungsten filament that were 70 watts, 100 watts. And, you know, I remember being a student, I would switch on the light and it looked like it would make the room darker. But we don't use those light bulbs anymore. We use, LED bulbs that are about 5 watts and you'd hardly ever need to change them. So that's a use of resources and energy that's much more efficient. And certainly in the UK, it's something I heard that the last quarter of 2019 was the first time that more energy was generated using renewables than using fossil fuels. Mm. I don't know if that's been repeated, but once you've got it once, you're going to do it again and again and again and again.
And you said in your book, In Search of Deep Time, that Darwinism is dynamic. It's about becoming, not being, and we are surely still becoming as well.
There has been an argument that human evolution has stopped because we can compensate for people who have illnesses or various other problems. Well, that in itself is an evolutionary act. Evolution never stops. Evolution is not some personification or some external force. Evolution is simply what happens when you have superabundance of offspring or just offspring. and a mutation rate and environmental change. Evolution is always, always happening. Evolution happens more, though, when you have very small isolated populations. Now, at the moment, we're one big homogeneous population. So no matter how different we all look, human beings are very, very samey. And this is because all human beings evolved quite recently from a very small population. So there's much less genetic variation in the whole of humanity than between a couple of troops of chimpanzees in forests in West Africa, which is kind of amazing. This makes us rather susceptible to pandemics. However, once the human population declines markedly, there will be smaller, more isolated populations, and they will, each one will be more prey to sudden random variation, and each one will have its own little quirks. It's an interesting thing in evolution that when you have isolated populations, they tend to suffer more from particular diseases because of things like inbreeding than the population at large. Here's an example. When the first Dutch settlers colonised the Cape Colony back in the 1700s, 1600s, there were less than 100 of them, but one of them had a gene for a disease called porphyria. And that means in the white Dutch population of South Africa now, there is a lot more incidence of porphyria than in the ancestral Dutch population, if you see what I mean. And so you find a lot of groups that tend to inbreed will have that sort of thing. And that will happen more as human beings decline, and it will happen particularly when human beings go into space. Now, here's the prognostication. I remember when I was a lad making my plastic model Saturn V rocket and lunar module, and we were all excited about people going to the moon. And nobody's been to the moon since then. Now, you could say, well, there hasn't been the political imperative. But part of the reason was technical inefficiency and enormous cost. I mean, the background is that back then, only large national governments could afford to have a space program. But now it's different. Quite small nations have a space program. Israel, the United Arab Emirates have a Mars program. So not small governments, but also wealthy private citizens. Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson, Elon Musk. They put a lot of their private fortunes into a space program where they do it just to fire rich people into space to look at the view. Now, that's space tourism. Now, you might say, well, it's only going to be the province of fabulously wealthy people. But 100 years ago, they said that about air travel. And here's another example of how rapidly technology happens. The first moon landing was in 1969. Almost 50 years to the day after the first transatlantic crossing by an aeroplane, which was a contraption made out of bits of balsa wood and string and lawnmower engines. Only 50 years separated those two events. Space travel is now a possibility for a larger number of people in the coming decades. And that's because people are doing more with less. They can afford to do more with less. Technology has become improved and reliable and miniaturized. I mean, you know, the computers in the Apollo mission had about the same brains as the chip in your washing machine. In fact, it looked like, if you look at these space capsules in the Apollo, it looks like they were firing people to the moon inside a washing machine. It's still expensive and insanely dangerous, but the same used to be true of air travel. And now it's cheap and very, very safe. Even, you know, fat old people can be astronauts now. You don't have to be an all-American gymnast and fighter pilot to go into astronaut training.
You're describing the near future, but of course your book looks back and so entertainingly tells us so much we don't know about the history of the Earth. But you cover millions and millions and millions of years, and you say in the book that global warming may postpone the next ice age, but excess carbon dioxide will be sucked up and the ice age to come will be sudden, Henry.
Yes. The thing about ice ages is they can happen rather quickly. What happens is at the end of an ice age, you tend to get sudden warmer periods and then a sudden cold period and then a sudden warmer period and a sudden cold period until it kind of stabilizes. And it's the same when a warm period, such as we're living in now, turns back into an ice age. You have sudden reverses. Now, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now is there's a higher concentration now than there has been since for the past 800,000 years, which is since the ice ages became quite severe. So it will put off the next glacial advance. But when it comes, it'll be very, very sudden, within less than a human lifetime. But eventually, after human beings have become extinct, the world will settle down to the great ice age that has been happening for 30 million years before human beings came along halfway through to interrupt it.
Organisms, I'm quoting from your book, when that time comes, organisms will combine to produce in the last ages of life on Earth a whole new kind of organism of a power and efficiency we can hardly imagine. Can you elucidate that for us?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. What I found while writing the book was that when presented with environmental challenge, living organisms tend to become more efficient and more communal, all the better to do more with less. So 2.5 billion years ago, just cast your mind back 2.5 billion years ago, there was an ice age that lasted 300 million years and covered the whole Earth. And the creatures that were living there were tiny bacteria. These responded by getting together lots of bacteria to produce a structure, a common structure, which we call the cell, from which we're all made of. The cells we're all made of, basically all their parts were once individual bacteria that got together to pool their resources to do more with less. It's just pure Adam Smith economics. And then as time went on, cells got together to produce animals and plants and fungi, things that are made of lots of cells together, with individual cells doing different things, like they're cells in your liver that just do livery things, and they're reproductive cells, and they're nerve cells in your brain, but they all live together in a single entity. But now what we're beginning to see is something called the superorganism, which is organisms working together. And there have been signs of this for quite a long time. In fact, going back millions of years, plants on land can only live because they have this symbiotic relationship with fungi in the soil. And you have social insects like ants. Each one is a multicellular organism, but they superimpose another level of complexity. So you have the queen ant, who's essentially the reproductive ant, and all the others are soldier ants and whatever. And if you look at human societies, you can think of each one of us as a component in an interacting society. And if you think about it, I don't think many people could support a life that they regard as comfortable if they had to do absolutely everything themselves from scratch. We all depend on other people to supply our needs. And this is because human society is becoming a kind of superorganism. And that might have contributed to human domination of the planet. So what I think is going to happen is, as the Earth progresses, organisms will tend more to that kind of social interdependent interaction, until in the last ages of the Earth, organisms will be kind of giant underground fungal-like structures that may penetrate for miles throughout the crust and maybe hundreds of meters down. And I paint a picture that maybe in the last days of the Earth, they will just be one organism that kind of romantic, I suppose. But I think that's the way life will go. It'll become much more of a highly organized social structure in which you'd be hard put to try and to tell which bit was a fungus and which bit was an animal and which bit was a plant. So it is very hard to imagine what such a creature would be. But we see the hints of it now in the figs and fig wasps and ants and anthills and plants and fungi and so on. So there are hints of it happening now.
I can't keep you all day, sad to say, because we've we haven't even really touched on some of the marvellous creatures from Earth's past, as well as all those evolving aspects of the planet itself. What creature from the spectacular past, animal past, would you most like to have seen with your own eyes? Because the Lystrosaurus seems to be right up your list.
Oh, yeah, I love the Lystrosaurus. It was the after the great Permian mass extinction 250 million years ago, where most life died because of one damn thing after another, lots of volcanic catastrophe. In the world that survived into the Triassic period, this animal called Lystrosaurus, ferociously ugly but unbelievably resourceful, it grew up like weeds on a bomb site. I don't have any pictures in the book, so I had to paint the pictures with words. And I describe Lystrosaurus as it had the body of a pig, the attitude to food of a golden retriever, and the head of an electric can opener. So basically, it just ate everything it came across, and it was not at all fussy. And it lived everywhere. It had a very happy-go-lucky, eat-anything-go-anywhere attitude. And for some millions of years, 19 out of 20 animals you'd have bumped into would have been a Lystrosaurus. Lystrosaurus saved the planet. I'd have loved to have seen some of them.
I'd love to have seen the Earth in the way that you described too. I have forgotten if I ever did know that there was no way for oceans to circle the Earth once and not all of them teemed with life. And the gigantic volcanic eruptions that created literal hell on Earth, and the Atlantic Ocean formed because of a giant pustule of magma threatening everything. Gee, you'd love to see a sped up video of all of this, wouldn't you?
Well, yes. Now, it's very interesting. The great thing about putting all this in a book is something the late great science fiction author Ian Banks said was the great thing about writing science fiction rather than making films is you have an unlimited special effects budget. asteroid impact, no problem, you just write it down. Volcanic eruption that wipes out the planet, no problem, you just describe it. And the history of the Earth is not a made-up story, it's what happened, or at least trying to use the evidence that we have to string together to make a story. But it's such a great story. And what I wanted to do with the book was tell the story like a kind of bedtime story for grown-ups. Because I thought, this is just fabulous. It's got villains and heroes and cliffhangers and spectacular events and victory pulled out of the jaws of defeat and tragedy and triumph. It's all you need is the love interest and you're there. it's just such a great tale, and I just had to write it down.
Well, the love interest actually comes from your enthusiasm and skill, I think, because it's a gripping tale.
Well, thank you very much. That's what I hope. I wanted to write a tale that people would read like a story and couldn't wait to read the next exciting instalment.
Very good of you to talk with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Jim. It's very kind of you to invite me on. And have a great day.
A number of you who tuned in halfway through that have been asking who our guest was. Dr. Henry G., paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, and senior editor for the journal Nature. And his latest book, which we managed to delve into to a minor extent in between Prophecies of Doom, is A Very Short History of Life on Earth, spanning 4.5 billion years.